It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk to a Supreme Court reporter about some of the decisions the court announced earlier today.
First, there's been growing attention to so-called zombie homes in Milwaukee and around the country.
Zombie homes are vacant properties. Some have been foreclosed on but never sold. Some, the owners have left their homes during the foreclosure process and are unable to pay their mortgages.
These homes often fall into disrepair, and some even end up housing illegal activities. They exist throughout various neighborhoods in Milwaukee and in communities around the country.
Joining us now in our Milwaukee studio, we have Art Dahlberg. He's commissioner of the Milwaukee Department of Neighborhood Services. Art, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
And also with us is Kathleen Patron, organizer at Common Ground. Common Ground works to rehabilitate rundown homes in the Milwaukee area. Kathleen, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
So, Art, first of all, how does a zombie property come into being?
Well, the first thing that happens is it's going through a bank foreclosure process. So the bank has to follow certain steps to be able to initiate that. But somewhere along the line, the people that are the owners of the property make a decision that it's no longer in their best interest to be in the property for one reason or the other. And they leave that property. So now it's an abandoned property sitting in a neighborhood. And by definition, that's really what a zombie property is something that's going through lender foreclosure, hasn't gotten to a point of a sheriff's sale where it can move to a new owner, and the current property owner is no longer residing at the property.
So the property owner still technically owns it, but there's nobody actually tending it in any way in that case.
That's right. And many times the owner has moved in with family or friends, maybe local, maybe halfway across the country. The community doesn't know where they are. So we really have an untended property. So from a city's perspective, that's where we start having a source of nuisance activity and blight in our neighborhoods.
And Kathleen, let's get into that. I mean, it sounds just off the top of my head, oh, it's just an empty house. Why is that a problem for the wider neighborhood and community?
There are numerous problems regarding the issue. When you have an empty house, immediately it attracts attention, and typically unwanted attention. And working with Common Ground, I had the opportunity to go door-to-door on blocks, talking with neighbors who specifically live next to these empty properties. They can go online and they can check the ownership of the property, but a lot of times the search stops there and they're left with frustration. A lot of times they end up cutting the grass themselves. They take care of the property themselves. And there's a lot of unwanted attention when it comes to drug use, prostitution, and homeless issues, where people will actually light fires in the living room to stay warm in the wintertime, which then can cause a house fire. And so there's a lot of issues involved with that.
Yeah, when I think of the uptick in foreclosures we saw with the recession, I thought of that as a symptom and consequence of a wider problem, but it sounds like it's actually a cause in and of itself, these houses, of more problems in their neighborhoods.
Absolutely. They're a huge problem, and slowly but surely, you know, one house goes vacant, and then, you know, I've talked with a woman next door to a house that was empty, and her husband had passed away. She was an older adult. She knew she couldn't sell the house for the value that she had in the property, and so she then considered herself, well, maybe I'm just going to walk away from my home. And so it's this domino effect that you hear these stories and people just keep walking away.
And Art, I imagine you can see how this would affect property values. How big an impact can a zombie property, these abandoned houses, have on surrounding property values?
Well, it certainly does. But it goes even beyond the property value piece. It really institutes criminal behavior and criminal activity into the neighborhood, which really makes our neighbors sort of give up on their neighborhood and on their property. But without going into statistics, one house on a block may not affect the property values, but once you start getting two or three homes on a block, you start seeing a multiple digit drop in the value of the property.
And Art, how many zombie properties do we know of in Milwaukee?
Well, since we've been tracking it, it sort of ranges around from 330 to 450 or so. So not a large number when compared with the number of properties that have gone through foreclosure in our community. But these are the ones that They become surprises for everybody on the block face. They become surprises for the municipality. And they become those sources of criminal activity. They become, as Kathleen says, a source of potential fire in the neighborhood. So they put the entire community at risk and deteriorate the entire community.
And Kathleen, do we see these concentrated in certain neighborhoods, or are they really hit or miss all over the city?
I would say there are certain areas that are affected more by this issue, but they can pop up anywhere. Common Ground specifically has targeted working in Sherman Park and about 130 square block area in Sherman Park. And so our goal is to really be targeted about our work. And so I can speak most specifically to that area. But we've seen them pop up throughout our entire square block area, really just out of nowhere, and it's the ones that are long-term vacant properties.
We'll talk a little more about what community groups like yours and what the city can do about this, but there's been a lot of talk about the role of banks in this problem. Art, let's start with you. What do you see the bank's role in this? What would you like to see from the banks who hold these mortgages and maybe started foreclosure but dropped back out of the procedure?
Well, I think the first thing that I would like to see the banks do is be really monitoring these properties. They have an investment in these properties, and so we would really like them to do what the city ordinance says, which is they need to be monitoring these properties on a 30-day cycle and be taking action to keep, at the very minimum, keep them secure. And I think the next thing that the city would like to see them do is actually engage in what state law allows them to do, which is request a fast track of the sheriff's sale. So when we see that the property is no longer occupied, they can request for the sale of the property to happen within 5 weeks. And case after case after case, we see that they don't want to make that request, which is quite frankly quite puzzling to us.
What have the banks told you when you've talked to them and asked them to do this?
Well, they, for example, one of the things we ask them to do is, why aren't you protecting the investment that you're making into this property? I mean, they've written the note on the property, so maintaining the value of the property should make a lot of sense. And yet they tell us that they can't go onto the property and make repairs because it would effectively be trespassing. Yet when you look at real estate contracts, almost every real estate contract gives the lender the right to go on the property and take actions necessary to maintain the value of the investment. So it is puzzling.
It is above and beyond business and usual for a bank, I would imagine, though.
I think so, and I think certainly the life of an ordinary banker has changed a lot over the last 7 or 8 years, just like the life of code enforcement has changed a lot with the advent of the foreclosure problem. But we all have to adjust to that, and it's really in the best interest of not only the community but also in the lending institution to make sure that you don't lose the value of these properties. We see that when these properties get broken into, one of the things that happens is people go in and strip everything of value out of it, seeking the copper and the metal out of the building. Those criminal activities results in many of our central city homes now have to be demoed. We can't save those buildings. So we just finished demoing 200 properties in the first half of this year, and many of them started as a foreclosure.
Kathleen, in the community you're working with, is this a new problem, do you think, from the 2008 financial crisis? Or when you talk to community members, is this a problem that's always been there?
It definitely has heightened since the 2008 financial crash. Common Ground, our original campaign was actually in 2009. Our campaign was to actively go and negotiate with the banks to have them reinvest in communities that were hit by foreclosure. So we are now, as of 2011, we've started to rehab houses. But really a lot of the pre-work before we started the actual development was a campaign to get the banks to reinvest into neighborhoods hit by foreclosure. And so Common Ground was really at the forefront, I would say, at trying to hold the banks responsible for neighborhoods that they personally destroyed. And so it hasn't been a new problem. We were well aware of it in 2008. And so that was the start of our work. I would say that with the banks, we've moved from an adversarial position with them to working more closely with them so that we do have a line of communication that if there is a vacant property, we now can approach somebody at the bank who will actually listen to us and will either tear the property down, board it up, or donate it to Common Ground for rehabilitation. And so I would say that we've gotten closer to working with the banks, but it has been a problem. It just took us a while to actually get in relationship with the banks to be able to do something about it.
We're talking to Art Dahlberg. He's commissioner of the Milwaukee Department of Neighborhood Services, and Kathleen Patron, organizer at Common Ground. We're talking about so-called zombie properties in Milwaukee. These are unoccupied homes whose owners can't be tracked down in some cases, falling into disrepair in neighborhoods around the city.
And we'd like to hear from you whether or not you live in Milwaukee. Are there zombie homes in your neighborhood, and how do they affect the community? What would you like to see done with them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back with Art Dahlberg. He's commissioner of the Milwaukee Department of Neighborhood Services. And we have Kathleen Patron. She's an organizer at Common Ground. We're talking about so-called zombie properties in Milwaukee, unoccupied homes falling into disrepair. The owners still technically own them, didn't quite go through the entire foreclosure procedure, but not maintaining them.
And we'd like to hear from you on this, whether or not you live in Milwaukee. Are there zombie homes that are making a difference in the way your neighborhood feels or functions? How do they affect your community, and what would you like to see done with them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get your calls in just a moment. But Kathleen, I want to hear about a success story. When you get the home, in some cases donated by the bank, you fix it up. How does the neighborhood change? How do people in the community view that change?
Absolutely. There are two blocks right in Sherman Park that we focused on right away. There was one home that was fixed up and on the market for $104,000. And between the two blocks, there were 10 boarded up properties, or 10 boarded up properties between the two blocks. And we had to go through the process of figuring out who owns the property, how do we get it into our control, and then how do we get it rehabbed and sold to a responsible homeowner. And honestly, going through all of those blocks, it took about 2 years to get every single property for a variety of reasons. So one was owned technically by Deutsche Bank, which we then found out was Bank of America, and it was one of the so-called zombie properties. It was a property that was foreclosed on in August of 2008. The woman had walked away, and it wasn't until August of that year, 2011, that the property actually went to sheriff's sale. By that time, it already had a raise order on it, and it unfortunately couldn't be salvaged and rehabbed by Common Ground. And then moving forward, it was a similar story with each of those homes. One home, a gentleman had walked away from it, and he actually moved to Ohio. And we looked up his information on the city website, and we were able to get in contact with him. We said, hey, we're rehabbing houses on these blocks. What are you doing with your property? We'd be interested in either rehabbing it for you, we'll buy it from you. And he actually ended up moving back from Ohio. He rehabbed the property himself and sold it to owner occupancy. And so that was one of the 10 houses that was fixed up. But it's a constant struggle to really figure out who do we actually talk to either have them rehab this house or for us to be able to acquire to rehab it. And so it's that in-between period of the constant who owns it is the struggle for that. But it's been a huge success. All of the homes between the two blocks are now rehabbed and owner-occupied.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Tariq on the line in Milwaukee. Tariq, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Speaking to the previous person that took my message, as far as the small residential homes, I'm not too sure, you know, exactly what to do about them. But as far as the bigger properties, you know, like the ones that are size of apartment buildings, I think it'd be a really interesting idea and pretty cool idea to do, like, urban farming, such as, like, growing power. There was also Sweet Waters on Kinnickinnick Avenue.
Tariq, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Art, first of all, are we mostly talking about, you know, single-family residential homes, or are some of these properties larger, maybe apartment buildings?
Well, the majority of the ones that we would call a zombie property, which means they become completely vacant, those are really single-family or duplexes throughout the city of Milwaukee. You do see a lot of multifamily going through foreclosure, but usually at least some of the tenants are being kept in the building for cash flow purposes. So there isn't that same level of walking away and abandonment. But sort of going to that urban gardening, the Common Council just recently passed some community garden legislation to really try and take some of the vacant lots that get created when buildings have to be demolished and return them to at least a productive green space use within the community, and the community gets to come together and work the parcel of land together, and it's a very good neighborhood building exercise as well.
And Kathleen, would you see that as a positive ending to a story like the one you told of that house that ended up being razed in a vacant lot, if it could at least end up being a community garden?
Absolutely. Once the house finally came down, the property I just told you about, we had a very lively community meeting where all of the neighbors on the block, for the most part, showed up trying to decide what would eventually happen with that empty lot. And most of them said, you know, we never really even imagined the property would come down. We didn't think it would actually come to this day. And they actually do have some community gardens right in that area.
Thanks for the call, Tariq. We'll go now to Kyle in East Troy. Kyle, hi.
Hi. I'm a former employee of a title company, and one of the behaviors I saw banks do all the time was to play the money market before issuing the mortgage documents. So my question is, does it pay for the bank to do all these things, or is it more in their best interest to take it as a tax write-off? And if that's the case, how do we change the rules and our laws to change that behavior? And I will take my answer off here.
Kyle, thanks for the call. Art, is there some financial incentive for banks to just keep these things the way they are?
Yeah, we've been trying to understand that for the past several years. Really, what is the financial motivation for somebody not to protect their investment in a property? And every time we pose that question, we don't quite get clarity in an answer. But I will say, ultimately, I think part of the solution has to be what we see is happening in, for example, New Jersey, and what the Attorney General in the state of New York has started to propose, which is saying that when a lending institution institutes an action to start foreclosing on a property and people leave the property, that lending institution now becomes responsible for maintaining the property, just as the property owner is responsible for maintaining that property, so that they have more skin in the game. It may mean that they evaluate whether or not it's truly a good candidate to go through foreclosure. And I think that's part of what needs to be done, is a more cautious look before you jump the gun and go into foreclosure. What is the end result the lending institution is looking for, and be a little bit more intelligent in this process.
Art, has anyone talked about eminent domain as an option for the city to take over properties if they're there for 3-4 years abandoned?
Well, one of the things that while not eminent domain, and we've certainly been watching some of the cases out in California that have been pursuing the idea of doing eminent domain and then re-underwriting loans, more importantly, many of these properties, they don't pay their taxes either. So you see a fair number of these properties ultimately coming to the city through a tax foreclosure process, in which case the city is doing the right thing. The city is tearing down the blighted ones, and the city is trying to get the property into responsible property owners' hands to do repair work on those that don't need to be torn down.
And Kathleen, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask, that neighborhood meeting you described, it sounds like a neighborhood you have people committed to making things better. How important is it to deal with this obstacle, these so-called zombie homes, to help them rebuild their communities and build up their neighborhoods?
In the end, I think it comes down to neighbors are taking care of these houses. I mean, you go and you talk to neighbors on the blocks, and it's the neighbors who are cutting the grass. It's the neighbors who have a schedule of who is taking care of what houses. And so it's absolutely important to make sure that communities are involved. And Common Ground has member organizations. And so we were founded and working in Sherman Park long before we even started this campaign, working with local churches. We have about 6 Common Ground member institutions within the neighborhood. And so it's about teaching people, how do you navigate this system? What numbers do you call at the city to make sure that the house is boarded up? How do you look up a property ownership? And then how do you, as an institution, say a church in Sherman Park, try to address this issue, because it has to come from neighbors, because it's really truly affecting people there.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Art, thanks to you.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Art Dahlberg. He's commissioner of the Milwaukee Department of Neighborhood Services, and Kathleen Patron, organizer at Common Ground. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, some surprising facts and unanswered questions about allergies.
First, we're getting the latest news out of the Supreme Court. The court is racing to issue opinions in several cases before the end of the month, and this morning they announced a handful of decisions.
Adam Liptak is here to fill us in. He's the Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start with an announcement about a case out of Wisconsin. The Supreme Court announced that it will not take up a case about a public school graduation in an evangelical church here in the state. What does the decision mean?
It was a bit of a surprise, because the court has this term indicated a receptiveness to some role for religion in public life, ruling that town board meetings can start with a prayer. And you might have thought that they'd take a case on whether a high school graduation can take place in a church with lots of religious Christian symbolism. But the court turned it down over a dissent from 2 justices, Justices Scalia and Justice Thomas, who said they should have taken it, or at a minimum, sent the case back to the lower courts for reconsideration in light of the legislative town hall prayer meeting, prayer case.
Right. And as you say, it seemed as though this Wisconsin case could have allowed the justices to extend that decision you were talking about to public schools, but they did the reverse. Why, in effect, did they draw the line there?
My best guess is that Justice Kennedy, the swing vote, thinks that government sanctioned religious displays are more okay when children are not involved. That is, when you have students going to a place where they're compelled to go and want to go for their graduations, the fact that they're minors makes a difference to them. And that probably means that neither side was sure they had his vote, and therefore they'd rather kick the can down the road.
And what do you think the decision says about the issue of separation of church and state looking forward?
Well, when the court turns down a case, which it does 99% of the time, they make a point of saying it doesn't establish a precedent, it doesn't disclose a point of view. So I wouldn't read very much into the fact that they turned this down. But I do think we saw in the town board meeting case, and are likely to see in a case in the next couple of weeks about religious companies' objections to this, the so-called contraception mandate, that this is a court where there's a receptiveness to some religion in government settings.
Well, let's move on to another fairly big decision here. The Supreme Court ruled against the gun lobby in a decision that gun buyers have to report when they're buying a gun for somebody else. How did that decision unfold?
Well, on the one hand, it seems fairly straightforward. A federal law says that you have to say if you're buying on behalf of someone else, and this person did not say, and was convicted of failing to disclose that he was a so-called straw buyer, and was sentenced to 5 years probation. What was a little bit surprising is that this statutory interpretation case divided 5-4 along the classic lines of Kennedy plus the 4 more liberal justices in the majority and the 4 more conservative justices in dissent. You see that more often in big controversial constitutional cases, where it's just a matter of interpreting the words of a statute. You don't see as many of these kinds of 5-4s.
And this was the second of 2 decisions going against the gun lobby. Does that signify anything?
I wouldn't be so quick to characterize it as a pro versus con gun lobby case. I would say that the court, ever since it established an individual right to bear arms under the Second Amendment in 2008, has almost entirely stayed out of the question. So it's basically let federal and state governments continue to impose gun regulations. So the early message of those that big Second Amendment case in 2008 seems not to have been followed through on.
And Judge Scalia issuing a pretty scathing dissension on this one. What do you know about what he said?
Justice Scalia said that at least when the person actually going to the counter to buy the gun is buying it for someone who's also eligible to have a gun, whether you make the disclosure or not is completely immaterial. By Scalia standards, it wasn't so scathing, but he did think the majority opinion by Justice Kagan was quite wrong.
Well, there's another one which has had some twists and turns, a major victory for the group Susan B. Anthony List, and the court has approved their lawsuit that it can go forward. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, Ohio has a law, and so do 15 other states, that makes it a crime, this will surprise you, makes it a crime to lie in a political campaign. And Susan B. Anthony List wanted to challenge that law. It had tried to put up a billboard saying that an incumbent congressman's vote for the Affordable Care Act was a vote for taxpayer-funded abortion. That's not clear that that's a true statement. And the Ohio Elections Commission said there was probable cause to think they'd commit a crime when by putting up that billboard. And they wanted to sue over the law and ask the question of, does the First Amendment allow the government to stop people from speaking in a political campaign? And the only question for the court was not the more interesting question of, is this law constitutional, but the threshold question of, had this group suffered a direct enough, imminent enough injury to be allowed to sue? And the court unanimously said yes. If nothing else, they can sue, and we'll decide later whether the law is constitutional.
So what happens next?
It goes back to the lower courts, and there's likely to be a trial.
And do you think it's likely to get kicked back upstairs to the Supreme Court?
I think it depends how it comes out. I think this is a court, judging by its earlier decisions, that is not comfortable with laws that make it a crime to speak in a political campaign. So if the lower court were to strike down the law, I don't know that it goes back to the Supreme Court. If the lower court says that law is fine, the Supreme Court's quite likely to intercede.
How important do you think that this particular case is?
Oh, I think it's... the particular case, you know, maybe not so much. The general issue of how much the government can regulate speech in a political setting is very important and goes to the core of the First Amendment and is not wholly unrelated to cases like Citizens United, which also rely on the First Amendment to characterize corporate expenditures as political speech. So it fits into the court's jurisprudence more generally.
And the court has announced that it's going to turn away from an appeal in Argentina. The nation tried to appeal a decision requiring it to pay holders of bonds on which it had defaulted. Give us a little bit of the backstory there.
Yes, so this is a financially very important case. Argentina defaulted in 2001 on billions of dollars of debt. And 92% of the people who held those bonds agreed to take an enormous haircut, to take 20 or 25 cents on the dollar. But a few people didn't, and they sued, and they said Argentina was not entitled to force them into that kind of restructuring. And the lower courts in New York agreed, and the Supreme Court, by not agreeing to hear the case today, now has put Argentina to what will be a very difficult choice for it, of whether to default yet again or to pay out these holdout bondholders probably $15 billion, which is an enormous shock to that economy.
Well, looking ahead, the court has a lot of work ahead of it in just the next couple of weeks. One of the biggest cases still on the table is the so-called Hobby Lobby case, the craft giant challenging government-mandated birth control. What are you expecting there?
I think more likely than not, the court says two things. First of all, that at least some closely held corporations that say they want to operate on a religious basis do have religious liberty rights. And then it probably goes on to say, I would guess by a 5-4 majority, that those rights were violated by a law that would force companies to provide contraceptive coverage to women, where those companies contend that at least some of the drugs and devices involved are tantamount to abortion. That's speculation, of course. We'll find out in the next couple of weeks. But they have a lot of big cases yet to come in the next 2 weeks.
And just in our last minute here, there's a slew of other things. I think it's fair to call it a slew. What's sticking up on your radar as some of the biggest things they have to decide?
Oh, I like the case about protest zones around abortion clinics, about whether the police can search your cell phone if they arrest you, about recess appointments, about a service called Aereo that streams broadcast television over the Internet, one about greenhouse gases. Today wasn't such a big day at the court, but the next few days of decisions are going to be big ones.
Great. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us and getting us up to speed.
Thanks for having me.
That was Adam Liptak, Supreme Court reporter for The New York Times. Seasonal allergy sufferers are feeling the sneeze and the wheeze lately, but what's the science behind those allergies?
Our next guest is a science writer who looked into some of the latest research. Maggie Kurth-Baker joins us. She's science editor at boingboing.net. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're based in the Midwest. How are your allergies, if any, so far this year?
Mine are okay. My baby daughter has had a runny nose for the last couple of months, but otherwise I think we're doing pretty good.
Yeah, I've been on and off fine and then bursts of sudden sneezing for no apparent reason. Well, let's get into that runny nose you mentioned. If my nose is running during allergy season, what am I getting out of it? What's the function of the runny nose?
Well, the interesting thing is that we don't really know what the function of the runny nose is. You know, there's been some speculation in the past that having your nose run could be your body's way of trying to sort of flush invaders out of your nose. But that doesn't totally match up with the data. And so researchers are sort of left thinking that we don't necessarily even have a reason why your nose runs, that could just be a side effect of this process that happens when you get something into your body that your body thinks shouldn't be there, even when it doesn't really matter, which is the case of pollen.
Yeah, I always assume that this is a way of ejecting the stuff that's annoying us, but apparently maybe not.
No, yeah. I mean, for one thing, pollen shouldn't even be something that annoys your body. It's not something that's a threat. It's not something that's really particularly dangerous. And having your nose running doesn't necessarily do the job of, like, you know, getting the pollen out of your nose. So it could just be a side effect of what happens once this whole immune system response gets going. You end up with a domino effect that leads to a runny nose, even though the runny nose doesn't help you in any way.
That's one of the most annoying side effects, and it's doing nothing. I find that kind of annoying, actually. Who do I complain
reasonable.
To about that? Well, and then speaking of weird allergy things, when we meet an allergen for the first time, like if I'm going to be allergic to a particular kind of pollen, say, am I going to react to it the first time I run across it?
No, actually. So the way that the whole system works is that your body has to encounter the allergen first. And that first time that it encounters the allergen, it starts making this stuff called immunoglobulin E, which are these little receptors that the next time you encounter that allergen, they will then tell these cells called mast cells that are filled with histamine, which is the stuff that you've heard about with antihistamine medication. Mm-hmm. It tells these mast cells to release all this histamine into your body, and it's the histamine that causes the symptoms that we think of when we think of allergies. But that process doesn't happen the first time. Like I say, you have to have your body has to encounter the allergen once, then have the time to make all of this immunoglobulin, and then the next time you encounter it, if you've got enough immunoglobulin, then the actual process starts. So the process of going through and making that immunoglobulin can take 4 to 6 weeks. So depending on the kind of allergy the kind of allergen you're talking about, it might be something where you move to a new place and you encounter pollen and you don't have an allergy until the next spring, because the first spring your body was just in the process of preparing to have allergies the next time.
So it could trick you. I might think, oh, my spring allergies are gone in this new place. How happy. And then not
right.
learn the truth until a year later.
Right, exactly.
So when it's doing that, that first encounter, the die is already cast, right? Your body knows it's going to start getting ready to react to it. It's not meeting in committee for 4 to 6 weeks deciding whether you're allergic.
No, it's not. It's not deciding whether you're allergic. It's in the process of making the immunoglobulin that is going to launch that allergic reaction the next time.
Now, it seems like I hear about more people getting allergic, and that just could be who I know or where I live or something like that. Are allergies, diagnosed allergies, getting more common?
They are, actually. 50% of the population is now allergic to at least one thing in the United States, and we don't really know exactly why that is. You know, there's this idea that you've probably heard of called the hygiene hypothesis, which is basically this idea that, you know, we've gotten these much cleaner, much more sanitary lives in, you know, the past 100 years or so. And maybe if you have a life that's too clean and too sanitary when you're a small child, your immune system never learns how to not freak out over every small thing it encounters. And if it never learns that, then maybe you have more allergies when you get older. The problem with that is that there are some good reasons to think that that doesn't totally explain the increase in allergies in the U.S. I mean, for one thing, you have 50% of Americans who aren't allergic to anything. But when you go back and look at their childhoods, they haven't had any less hygienic childhood. You know, it's not like they were rolling around in the dirt, and so now they don't have allergies. And your mom kept you too clean as a kid, so now you do. There's just some people who have allergies and some people who don't, and more people who did in the past, and we don't know why.
Is it possibly a case where we're just better at diagnosing allergies and we would have just ignored it in the past, or are we really seeing an increase?
They do say we are really seeing an increase.
Okay.
I'm sure that there is some element of, you know, we have more medications to treat this stuff now, so people pay attention to it more, and maybe you have something that you think is a cold, that is actually a cold, but you think is allergies, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you aren't actually going to the doctor and getting diagnosed. It's easy sometimes to mistake one thing for the other. But the experts do say we are seeing more people with more allergies.
Getting back to the hygiene hypothesis, is that being abandoned now, or are they trying to drill down finer and see if there's something more specific that we're overlooking?
Well, it's certainly not being abandoned. It's something that does explain some things that we see, but just doesn't seem to explain everything. So what the scientists are really trying to do now is sort of try to figure out whether the hygiene hypothesis actually is an explainer of some of the things that are going on with allergens, but then also what else could be contributing to this? Because it seems like right now, you know, the hygiene hypothesis could be part of what's happening, but it's probably not the entirety of what's happening. So they need to kind of get more down into that data and figure out what else is there. Because, you know, you have things like, for instance, asthma is the same sort of response with, you know, the immunoglobulin and the mast cells and the histamines, just like we have with a runny nose, but it's just in a different place in your body. And asthma rates are actually going down as a whole throughout the U.S. and in other Western countries, but those countries haven't gotten any grubbier childhoods lately. Right. So meanwhile, you have small specific populations in those countries, like African Americans in the U.S. who live in poverty, where asthma rates are rising, but childhood hygiene hasn't really changed in those communities either. So there's clearly something else going on there beyond the hygiene hypothesis, and we just need to study this stuff more and figure out what that other thing is.
One other mystery you wrote about is placebos maybe for some allergy sufferers being effective. How would that work?
Well, it's kind of a weird thing is that, you know, experts tell me the placebos work really well to treat your allergies. So the placebo effect for allergies is around 20 to 40%, which is really, really high. And it means that, so for instance, people taking Claritin, you experience a 46% improvement in symptoms. But in the same study, you have people who are taking the placebo who saw their symptoms improve by 35%.
Wow.
So, right, yeah. You know, so there's not much of a difference between the placebo and the actual drug. Part of that issue is probably the fact that, you know, this is qualitative symptoms, not quantitative symptoms. You know, nobody's sitting there measuring the amount of snot coming out of your nose. This is all like, do you feel better today? How did you feel? And that can get sort of messy when you actually start trying to quantify those qualitative ideas. But then another thing is also that, you know, the FDA does its studies on allergy medications using people who are already experiencing allergy symptoms. If you didn't do that, then you wouldn't necessarily know, you know, if you took a bunch of people who weren't already experiencing allergies and you started testing an allergy drug on them, well, you wouldn't know which ones it actually worked for and which ones just weren't going to get allergies to begin with. So there's a good reason they do that, but on the other hand, it means that it's hard to separate the effectiveness of the allergy drug from just the normal cycle of how a seasonal allergy works. You know, it peaks and then it falls off, and if you wait long enough, it's going to go away anyway. So there's a lot of confounding factors here, but there is still just this signal that, you know, to a certain extent, you can make yourself feel better by thinking that you should feel better. And whatever you happen to attach that to can't help.
Well, I'll try taking some placebos this season. Maggie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
That was Maggie Kurth-Baker. She's science editor at BoingBoing.net.